Welcome to the Conference for Women teleclass. Life is not a stress rehearsal. Practical tips to stress less and laugh more. Our guest today is Loretta LaRoche, a stress management consultant for over 30 years. Her unique approach is the use of humor as a coping mechanism. She has spoken to clients including NASA, the New York Times, Microsoft, and a host of other Fortune 500 companies, hospitals, and organizations. Loretta LaRoche has been the star of 7 PBS shows and is the author of 7 books, including Life is Short, Wear Your Party Pants. Her career path has also included many one-woman shows across the country, and her passion for singing has led her to create a jazz album. We'll be sharing highlights from today's call on Twitter. You can follow along and join the conversation at Penn Women, at Texas Women, at Mass Women, and in California at hashtag LeadOnCA. And remember, today's teleclass will be available as a podcast on your conference website. If you registered through Eventbrite, you will receive an email telling you when the podcast is available. Loretta LaRoche, welcome to the Conference for Women teleclass.
Thank you so much, Karen. That was a lovely introduction.
Well, good. I'm wearing my party pants today.
Oh, thank God. We should really wear them every day.
Can you tell us, first of all, what got you started in this career as a stress management through humor consultant?
Well, it was a rather circuitous journey. My degree is in speech therapy and communications, but I didn't really start working until I got divorced. I had 3 children, and I had to help support them, and my degree was really not going to help me at that time, so I decided to refer back to my dance background and created a program that incorporated dance with exercise. And it was kind of revolutionary. No one was doing that at that time. But what made it really fly was my sense of humor. I would get people to laugh as they lifted their legs. And then I discovered that many of my clients had problems with stress. So I began studying the science and psychology of stress. I went to New York and took classes with Albert Ellis, who is the father of rational emotive therapy, who is an absolute curmudgeon and fascinating. And then I also read an incredible amount of work by Dr. Viktor Frankl, who developed logotherapy. And it sort of really fit my personality, because one of the things he uses is something called paradoxical intention, which is the use of exaggeration to help reframe some distressing thoughts. So my innate ability to detect absurdity became the framework to help others see the comedy that was often inherent in their own irrational thoughts. And I also love to laugh and have been privileged to work with Norman Cousins and Patch Adams, both who find humor to be a therapeutic tool for themselves. And, of course, Patch helped discover the Gesundheit Institute, where he wanted patients to really feed into healing through nature and laughter and exercise and fun. And then I became a devotee of Buddhism, and I love their insights into the human mind and how our thinking often increases our need to suffer, which is a very Western modality. And my motto is, well, we're all going to suffer. Why practice in advance?
So it sounds like you had some terrific mentors along the way.
Oh, I've been very blessed. I mean, I'm an author at Hay House, so I've met Wayne Dyer, and Joan Borisenko has been a dear friend of mine for years, and Chris Northrup, and a host of other people. I'm just feel grateful that I've been on this journey.
So let's talk about stress reduction through humor. One of the things you write about is that we have morphed in from human beings into human doings.
Exactly.
And how does that affect our ability to savor life?
Well, I'd like to just give some background. You know, over a period of time, probably the last 20 years, because when I was growing up, people didn't even discuss stress. You know, my grandmother would cook all day, do shopping, take care of kids, but she never said, oh, my God, I'm so stressed. I better go to a spin class. You know, she just went through the day. And as a result, over the years, we've become more stressed, overwhelmed, and enjoy fewer leisure hours. And that's data from the Carnegie Mellon Laboratory for the study of stress, immunity, and disease. And people don't realize that stress diminishes productivity, depresses the immune system, shrinks the hippocampus, which is the seat of memory, and makes you more irritable and overreactive. And when you compare the 1980s to today, the economic pressures are greater, it's harder to turn off information, and people are suffering from something called FOMO, F-O-M-O, which is fear of missing out. You know, God forbid you don't look into something right away. You know, you might miss out, and then you have to take a picture of yourself getting the information and sending it to people. And now, $900 million to $2.1 billion is spent on anti-anxiety medications. Isn't that unbelievable?
It really is, yeah.
The average high school kid today has the same level of anxiety as the average psychiatric patient in the 1950s. So, I mean, I find all of this extraordinary. We've also lost our extended family and sense of community. I mean, I spent hours with my grandparents. My grandmother didn't worry about going to the gym and toning her arms because her arms were weapons. She'd hit you with the part that was dangling if you were bad.
FOMO that you talk about, is that the fear of missing the text or the email or the post
on
social media?
Fear of missing anything.
Mm-hmm.
We have this need to know now, need to know about everything. And, you know, that when you get that little ding or ping when you get a text, it actually increases a dopamine response in your brain, which is center for pleasure. So you almost become addicted to that sound, and you don't want to miss anything. So it's really tough to get away from all of these bells and whistles and information. And a lot of times you want to tell other people about it. Oh, I got this text. I found this out. And it's almost become a way of entertaining ourselves. And we don't have a lot of face-to-face encounters the way I did when I was growing up. You know, when I had kids, I lived in Levittown, New York, and the women would come over and we'd have a coffee klatch.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many people do that anymore. They probably, you know, maybe a few people who are home, they watch The View and have coffee by themselves.
So it sounds like you're saying people are more stressed and more isolated than they were earlier.
Oh, my God, yeah. The latest research I read is that we have more feelings of loneliness now than ever before. And as a result, more people are on antidepressants. And see, we weren't designed to handle all this information. You know, neuroscientists have been studying this for years. We think we can multitask, but that's not the role of the brain. And most of what we hear today, a lot of it, is about fear, isn't it? You're always afraid of what you're eating. You might not be parenting correctly. Your relationship might not be good. There's a terrorist somewhere in the mall. I mean, it's hard to feel safe. So it's not as if a lot of the information is good, makes you feel happy.
Sure. Well, what are some of the mind traps that are inherent in this mentality you've been talking about, the human doing mentality?
Well, what I call mind traps are really analogous to irrational thinking or stinking thinking. And some of them are, number one, the need to be right. You know, a lot of people are just so intent on being right. God forbid they're not right. They can't be happy. And they'll you know, burden you and go into all kinds of arguments so that they feel good. And, of course, I think this is a Buddhist motto. Would you rather be happy or would you rather be right? And then there's all or nothing thinking. I have to do everything perfectly because anything less than that is a failure. And I find this distortion to be most prevalent in women. And it can lead to depression and anxiety. I mean, I've suffered from this, all or nothing. Everything had to be perfect. If you walked into my house, everything looked just right. I mean, I can remember being so ridiculous that I cleaned the oven dials with a Q-tip. And, you know, that goes back to a mother who always used to tell me, you have to do all of this because you never know. And I finally figured out, now I know. No one that short's coming to my house. Then there's a negative self-labeling. You know, I feel like a failure. I'm flawed. If people only knew who I really am, they wouldn't like me. And I think there was a book out years ago called The Imposter Syndrome, where people can't feel comfortable with themselves because they feel they're imposters. Then there's catastrophizing and awfulizing. If something bad's going to happen, it's just going to be awful, horrible, and terrible. And a lot of people suffer from that. And then they'll call someone else and tell them how awful they're feeling so they can create a group. Excessive need for approval. I can only be happy if people like me. If someone is upset, it's probably my fault. And then disqualifying the present. You know, I can't be here in the present moment and relax. I have to get things done. Then maybe I'll relax later. But when is later? When is someday? Someday's not a day of the week. And you hear people say they're going to be, you know, they'll have fun Friday, they'll relax, and they bring home the work, and they just keep going and going and going like the Energizer Rabbit. I'm sure you've come across people like that.
Sure. So let's just sum up the mind traps for folks who have just joined us. You've identified irrational thinking, all or nothing thinking, negative self-labeling, catastrophizing, excessive
and awfulizing.
Awfulizing, like that word.
Well, it's all irrational thinking, all of these thoughts process. And there's really a few more, but then it gets redundant. You know, the need to be right, excessive need for approval, and disqualifying the present moment.
Right. And why is it so difficult to change our thoughts and behaviors?
Well, we become habituated to our thinking patterns. They become what they call in cognitive behavioral therapy automatic responses. You know, how long, you know, have you tried not to sound like your mother at times?
Mm-hmm.
I know I have. I often say, oh my God, that's my mother coming out of my mouth. When I was bringing up my kids, I'd say, you never listen to me, you know. And she used to say that too. But, of course, all you're doing is confirming the very thing that they're doing. You never listen to me. That's what they're doing. They're not listening to you. And we get a lot of these messages from childhood. With, you know, they start very early on. And I call them the committee. We all have a committee we travel with. And it comes out in different ways. You know, some people's humor has been decreased by messages like, wipe that stupid grin off your face. You think that's funny? You'll see, you'll have children just like yourself. Or an excessive need to straighten up or keep things because, you know, you don't feel that you should use them now. My mother used to tell me that I had to make the bed every day because you never know. And so I became possessed by making the bed because I didn't know. And what is it that I didn't know? Really, it was a fear message that people could show up at the house and report me because I didn't make the bed. Now I call them the bed checkers. They report you if your bed's not made. And then there's people who have to save everything. It made sense when you were going through the Depression, but, you know, you don't need good towels just in case somebody shows up, not your family. Or telling people, don't go in that room, I just cleaned it. It's a room, it should be used. So we get these messages from the past. And then we have societal messages that can become ingrained, you know, how we're supposed to look, who we should become. And, you know, change takes time, and it takes self-reflection and practice and commitment and compassion towards our human frailties. So a lot of people find it difficult to change their thought patterns because they're not becoming the witness to their behavior. They're so steeped in it, they can't see it from a distance.
Do you find that women are more vulnerable when it comes to stress than men?
Absolutely. We are so vulnerable because our self-worth is often predicated on being nurturers, taking care of people, fixing things that, you know, don't seem to work around us, like family situations, the caretakers a lot of times for our parents when you're in that sandwich generation. I did it. I took care of my mother for a long time. You know, how we look, how others are behaving around us seems to influence us more than men. But the good news is that women have a great model for de-stressing. When we get together and laugh together, which women are good at, they laugh at themselves for the most part, we release oxytocin, which is a hormone that's found in mother's milk, which helps reduce stress.
What else do women do that helps to reduce stress?
Well, I think that, you know, I don't think shopping is necessarily a de-stressor, because you could end up with a credit card that you don't need all that money on, you know. But I think the fact that we are caretakers to a degree, if it doesn't cross the line, is a great thing for us. We love to take care of our families. We love to share. And we like to talk about our stuff with each other, you know, as long as it doesn't get obsessively negative. We really are good at sharing what's going on in our lives and asking for help for the most part. That's why we have these great close girlfriend relationships. Friend and befriend was a study, I believe it was by Susan Taylor, who said that's how women really get through stressful periods, with their good close friends.
Great. Well, I want to take a moment just to remind our listeners that we'll be sharing highlights from today's call on Twitter. You can follow along and join the conversation at Penn Women, at Texas Women, at Mass Women, and in California at #LeadOnCA. And another reminder, today's class will be available as a podcast on your conference website. If you registered through Eventbrite, you'll receive an email telling you when the podcast is available. So, Loretta, let's get back to stress reduction through humor.
Okay.
What are some techniques and tools that we can adopt to become less stressed?
Well, I think number one, learn how to use paradoxical intention, which is what Frankl writes about. You know, a lot of times
let's redefine that.
Well, paradoxical intention is the use of exaggeration. It's really what comedians do. They take situations and they blow them out of proportion. And what people don't realize is that we often do that, and we're not being funny. We're actually disturbing ourselves. So that if you're in a car driving and traffic gets on your nerves, you'll exaggerate the situation to the point of catastrophizing, like, oh, my God, isn't this traffic awful? I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm never going to get there. But then if you do it tongue-in-cheek, if you start to be the witness, in a way, to your behavior, and you see the comedic possibilities, in other words, say it out loud. Oh, no, I'm never going to get out of this situation. I'll be found in the car dead tomorrow with my hands gripping the wheel. They'll have to come with the jaws of death to get, what is it called? I think it's the jaws.
Jaws of life.
Jaws of life. They'll have to come with the jaws of life and pry me out of this car. My family will never find me. So, I mean, if you keep going like that, it becomes ridiculous. That's paradoxical intention. And if we did that with more often than not, we'd be laughing at ourselves, because that's the best thing that one can do, is to laugh at oneself. Because I always tell people, we're really the comic absurdity. Human beings are often quite funny, but they just don't get it.
You know, I was struck by the fact that you have consulted with NASA, and I'm just wondering, I don't think of NASA as a place of hilarity, but maybe you do.
Well, none of the places I've been to are places of hilarity. They're places where morale might have dropped, or change is occurring, or, you know, there are situations where there's restructuring or whatever. And I go in and just sort of make people look at their perceptions of the situation and try to adjust it, you know, like you would a rudder on a sailboat. You know, you don't have to go in this direction. Let's look at multiple directions. That's what the lens of humor allows us to do. We see a different focus. So it's not about getting people to laugh hysterically. It's about really becoming more lighthearted about the situation and putting things into perspective. Because when we lose our perspective, we lose our way, don't we?
Sure. Sure. And it seems like another technique that you talk about is to focus on what your strengths are and how they've served you in the past during difficult situations.
Well, that's a very big model of positive psychology. You know, they do a strength assessment. In Martin Seligman's book, he has at least 200 questions that ask you about your strengths. And let's face it, how have we survived our lives? We've survived them through using the strengths that are innate in our character. I mean, whether it's perseverance, humility, humor, compassion, kindness, humility, you know, there's so many, many different strengths. And all you have to do is sit down with someone who's been through something difficult and say, well, how did you do this? And if you can write down these strengths and build off them, the next time a situation occurs where you think, oh, I don't know how I'm ever going to go through this, maybe you'll refer back to your list and you say, wow, I have made it thus far and I can keep on going.
Okay. So if we're just reviewing the techniques and tools, one would be to explore the use of paradoxical intention, learning to laugh at oneself. One would be to look at your strengths and how they've served you in the past during difficult situations. And
yep.
Then another one you talk about is discovering the power of choice, acknowledge, accept, adapt, and act. Can you explain
that? Exactly. Well, when we look at those four concepts, it gives us a better perspective on problem solving. A lot of people will say, oh, I'm so stressed. Can you help me? And I'll say, well, what are you stressed about? And they'll say, everything. Well, it's not everything. Let's zero in on something. What is the something? What is the highest priority? So acknowledge what is the problem. Then decide if you can accept it. Do you have to change it? Maybe it's like the serenity prayer. You accept what you can't change. And then maybe you have to adapt, adjust yourself a little bit. Change your attitude a degree or two. And finally, action. Can you take some action if none of the above works? The best is to act on something. Make a plan and be accountable to it and think of what the end result would be if you acted. Because a lot of us talk about stuff for years. I mean, I was in a relationship with a husband for 7 years that didn't work. And all I did was, this isn't working. Well, you know, you need to change.
The relationship didn't work.
No. But it was also compromising me mm-hmm. and my health.
Mm-hmm.
So I made all kinds of excuses not to get out of it, but I finally had to confront it and say, all right, where's the fear coming from, and let's make a decision.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also talk about using what you call healthy distractions as a way to diffuse your stress.
Right.
What are some of those healthy distractions?
And that, too, is part and parcel of how positive psychology views their psychology model. And one of them, of course, is exercise, which is really, I consider to be almost the fountain of youth. It covers all the bases. It helps you mentally, physically, and spiritually. So if you can get out into nature, if possible, and exercise, it interrupts the stress cycle and actually improves memory and reduces depression and anxiety. But you can do some funny little movements in the moment. And what I tell people to do often is to twirl. You know, you see little kids twirling because they want to show off something. You know, look at me, watch me twirl. Well, if you use the incongruity model of humor, which is twirl and say what's bothering you, you'll interrupt the stress cycle. So you may go up to somebody you know or feel comfortable with and say, oh my gosh, I just can't take another minute of this day. It's driving me crazy. And then you twirl at the same time, and it sort of cancels it out because you start to laugh. Or you can walk backwards for a minute or two and tell somebody, I don't know whether I'm coming or going. Or maybe you just sway back and forth. You know, I tell people, just if you're in line and you're getting upset, just start swaying. Just rock a little bit back and forth. That's what we do with babies in a cradle. And if you try it, you'll see your energy starting to calm down. And I love animals. And when I watch elephants, they're always swaying. So they must know something we don't.
All right, elephant technique. Another technique you mentioned is brief meditation.
Yeah, a lot of people are reticent to really quiet the mind. And that's one of the problems today is that the mind is so occluded with thoughts, and you have 60,000 a day. And on top of it, you know, you're trying to process all this information and emails and texts. And so it creates chaos, and the brain needs space. So how do you create space? All right, you may not want to sit and do the lotus position and say om, but there are multiple ways. One of them is walking. You can walk and meditate. But this particular meditation is one that I've sort of shrunk down to its smallest possible denominator. It comes from Heart Math, which was developed by Dr. Childress and I out of Stockton, California. And it is certainly more lengthy. But what I tell people to do is just take a nice deep breath and try to relax, maybe take several breaths. And just put your hand on your heart and imagine someone that you have unconditional love for and who may in turn have it for you. And it doesn't have to be a person. It could actually be an animal. I had a cat that I absolutely adored after I was divorced. He was like a soulmate. And if you just sit with that, or stand. You can be anywhere because you could do this in 2 minutes after you get used to it. You will notice your whole body relaxing because love is really sort of part of the wisdom channel in the brain, and it really makes a big difference when we focus on love rather than stress.
Mm-hmm. So, Loretta, we've got just a couple of minutes left. I'm wondering what other techniques, maybe you could describe two others that you think are really crucial, healthy distractions to diffuse stress.
Well, I think for fun, you know, just for fun, write a song about your stress. When I do groups, I often get people to sit down and write a blues song or think about an opera. You know, opera is pretty funny. You can sing, I'm so stressed, and then you can do the other part, no, you're not. And, you know, you can sing it to the people around you, and maybe you do a group together and make a song if you're in an office. I also believe in appreciation as one of the greatest sources of de-stressing. Write down what you appreciate. You know, an office might have a bulletin board with things that people appreciate. They could write on a weekly basis or a monthly basis, because every time you think of what you have, you start to diminish what you think you don't have. And I think that's one of the most important things we can do is to appreciate, have gratitude. You know, you could even write a letter of gratitude to someone that has helped you in your life and read it to them in person if possible. All these things take your mind off of the craziness that we're now living in. And Get some costumes that reflect some of your personality. I have an Attila the Hun hat for my control freak side. Get yourself a cape if you're just the idol of perfection. And if you like to be really helpful, get yourself a little wand and a tiara and go around telling everybody, you know, it's a good thing I came in because I was sick, but I'm still here to help everyone mean, it's sort of like you become the actor in your own life, you know, and you and you make it fun. Because a lot of us are seeking fun, but you have to become the fun you're seeking, and then you're never waiting to enjoy yourself.
Well, these are wise words to live by. It's all we have time for today. But you can connect with Loretta on Twitter at Loretta LaRoche. You will get a podcast of this teleclass. You'll automatically receive an email notification when the podcast is ready online. Loretta, we want to thank you for joining today's class, and thank you to our audience for listening.
Well, thank you very much for having me.